A New Testament Perspective on the Old Testament, the second talk in a series entitled Did Jesus Have to Die, was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 6, 2008 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Last week I started a series of Sundays. I'm not exactly sure how long it'll go. It looks like it may go 4 or 5 Sundays before I'm done, where I'm ultimately wanting to answer the question, did Jesus have to die? I'm not going to answer that question today. For those of you who can't stand suspense, the answer is going to be yes and no. But but I'm wanting to build the case kind of slowly and incrementally here. Last week we looked at the Old Testament and the sacrificial system and the ritualistic system in the Old Testament, and what that was all about and why it was the way it was to a certain extent. I want to turn now to the New Testament and look at the way the New Testament authors looked back at the Old Testament. I kind of hinted at this last week, but my contention is that there is no one ritual in the Old Testament that captures what was happening when Jesus died on the cross. I think we have a tendency to way oversimplify the Bible, and in our tendency to oversimplify the Bible, we tend to be looking back at the Old Testament as if there's something in the Old Testament that wholly, completely, and adequately anticipates what happened with Jesus. And I'm going to argue before I'm done that nothing fully anticipates what was happening when Jesus died on the cross, that Jesus' death on the cross was a unique event. It was a complex event that was not altogether unanticipated. Was not altogether anticipated. It was anticipated to a degree, but it was not completely anticipated. So that's my contention. So when we look in the New Testament, what we find is the authors of the New Testament look at different images and analogies from the Old Testament and apply them to their understanding of what was happening when Jesus died on the cross. And sometimes they'll look at him as if he's a scapegoat. Sometimes they'll look at him as if he's a sacrifice or an offering. Sometimes they'll look at him like he's a redemption price. Sometimes they'll look at him as if he's the offering that the high priest is offering in the Day of Atonement. They have these different snapshots taken from images and pictures in the Old Testament, and they will apply them to Jesus. But I think we don't understand what they're doing if we understand them to be seeing a complete and total transference of what these Old Testament rituals meant and what Jesus' death meant. What they're intending to do, what they are doing, is they're triangulating to what Jesus' death, the significance of Jesus' death, by looking at it in a number of different ways, all of which are true, all of which are accurate, but none of which are exhaustive in understanding what's happening with Jesus' death on the cross. And my contention, as I mentioned last week, is it's not because they're creative geniuses that they're doing this. They're not making this up. It's not their cleverness in inventing a brand new religion out of the resources of Old Testament Judaism. That's not the way to look at it, I don't think. Rather, they're actually discovering what was actually there all along by divine intent. They are humble servants of the truth, not creative geniuses inventing a new religion. But that would be somewhat controversial. What I want to focus on here today is to try to make some sense out of some passages that I think paint a very definite picture for us about the relationship between all those sacrifices and rituals and all that liturgy that happens in the temple and what happened with Jesus. My contention is the apostles see the rituals and liturgy in the temple as what they call shadows of what was to come. And the relationship between the rituals and Jesus is, it's a partial outline of what Jesus is and what he accomplished, but it's not simply another version of the same thing. It's a shadow, not a prototype. And that relationship between all of the Old Testament law and Mosaic covenant and the truth that Jesus taught and that Jesus embodied in his life is seen throughout the New Testament, I would argue. And I want to look at a number of places where that's the case. Let's start with Hebrews. If you want to turn there, I'm going to look at Hebrews 5:11 through 6:3. Now, what I'm going to do here is, in a way, wholly inadequate because I'm not going into the whole context and I'm not going into the whole argument, but I think for my purposes, that's okay. I think that's going to be safe to do that. But I'm going to be working with my own sort of half-baked translation here, but I think you'll be able to follow along. I'm starting with Hebrews 5:11. He's just in the argument, he's just finished bringing up Melchizedek. For those of you who remember the book of Hebrews, he's been talking about Melchizedek. And this is on the heels of him having introduced Melchizedek into the argument. As for us, there is a long and difficult to explain account we need to give concerning this one, Melchizedek, since you have become slow in relation to such accounts. Now, though you have by this time the obligation to be teachers, you have need for someone to teach you once again the stoicheia. And that's the Greek word he uses. I'm just going to use that Greek word because one of the important issues is, what does it mean? What does that word stoicheia mean? You have need for someone to teach you once again the stoicheia from the beginning of the revelations of God. And you have come to be one who has need of milk, not solid food. Now, everyone who partakes of milk is inept at the account of dikaiosune, and that's the account of how one gains freedom from condemnation, that basically dikaiosune is being free from being condemned. Everyone who partakes of milk is inept at the account of dikaiosune, for he is but a child. Now, everyone who partakes of milk is unlearned in the account of dikaiosune. Whoops. I skipped that paragraph. Okay. Therefore, leaving behind the account of the first things which concern the Christ, let us bring you to the completed picture, not laying down or perhaps casting aside again the foundation of repentance from dead works and belief in God, of teachings about washings, about the placing on of hands, about the resurrection, and about the judgment in the age to come. And we will do just this, if God permits. So basically in this passage, what Paul or whoever wrote Hebrews is doing is he's kind of stepping aside. He wants to explain to them how Melchizedek anticipates in an important way who Jesus is and what he accomplished. That's what he wants to do in the letter. And after this passage, that's what he goes on to do in the letter. But before he does that, he's commenting on what he sees to be their spiritual state at that particular time, is that you have been taught the gospel, but although you have been taught the gospel, you don't even seem to understand anymore the foundational elements that go into understanding the gospel. And that's what I would argue is what he means by the stoicheia. That is, in order to understand the gospel, there are certain basic foundational ideas that you need to have a concept of and that you need to have an understanding of. If you don't have a concept or understanding of those things, how are you going to understand the gospel? How are you going to understand who Jesus is? How are you going to understand what he accomplished? If you don't even know the vocabulary to describe who Jesus is and what he accomplished. And where did he expect that they would have gotten that vocabulary and that those concepts? From what he calls the beginning of the revelations of God. And I think what he means by the beginning of the revelations of God is going back first to Abraham and then eventually to Moses. God has revealed his purposes to them through Moses and the prophets following Moses, bit by bit in pieces as he starts off the letter of Hebrews in various portions and in various ways. God has spoken to us through the prophets of old. So throughout the history of God's dealings with his people, he's introduced to them ideas about who he is and who they are and what their relationship is and what God intends to do in the world and so on. He's been introducing those concepts to them. Those are the stoicheia of the beginning of the revelations of God. Those are the stoicheia that got revealed to mankind and Israel in particular through the beginning of the revelations of God. Well, we have an account of in this very passage of what some of those stoicheia are. Repentance from dead works and belief in God, teachings about washings, about placing on of hands, about the resurrection, and about the judgment in the age to come. Having those concepts intact are crucial if you're going to understand who Jesus is, this man who died on the cross. How are we going to understand that if we don't understand some of these basic concepts? The washings, I think, are the various forms of purification that happened throughout their rituals, both with blood and at times with water. And the placing on of hands is the, for example, at the Day of Atonement and in any offering where the worshiper identified with the offering by placing their hand on the sacrificial animal. So I think those are references to the sacrificial system and the requirements of the sacrificial system. And he's calling those the elements, the foundational truths, the foundational teachings, the foundational concepts that you need to have in place if you're going to understand the gospel. But since you are even having trouble grasping the foundational concepts, you have need for someone to come back and teach those to you again. Because you don't even get that any longer. Because you have become slow, he says, slow of hearing or slow to take up on these ideas. Why have they become slow? We'd need to look at the whole letter for that. But he would argue because of this moral, spiritual problem of human rebellion. Throughout, the Bible sees a link between what I am able to understand and what I am willing to understand. And what I am willing to believe. If I'm not willing to believe something is true, I become dumb to it. I don't get it. I become slow at understanding it. Because the moral spiritual effect of hardening myself to truth is to make my mind incapable of going where it needs to go in order to understand and grasp that truth. Well, that's the author of Hebrews fears that's what's going on with his readers. You don't even know as much today as you knew 2 years ago because you're so hardened against the truth that you're dumbing yourself against these very concepts that are crucial to understand if you're going to understand what we apostles are claiming about Jesus. Notice here, when I was taught this passage, he goes on to say, you're a child. Everyone who partakes of milk is inept at the account of Dikaiosune, for he is but a child. Everyone who partakes of milk is unlearned in the account of Dikaiosune. This whole imagery of simply drinking in milk as opposed to eating solid food. When I was taught this, milk was the gospel, and solid food was, well, typology. Really being able to dig out the esoteric meanings of the scriptures that no ordinary human being would be able to grasp, that was the difference. But if we look at this in context, I think it's really pretty clear. The solid food is the gospel. The solid food is the message of Jesus. The solid food is the truth that every human being needs to know about the way to eternal life, as that is found in Jesus. That's the solid food. The milk is what Jesus was giving to the Jews over the course of their history in order to provide them with the nourishment, the intellectual, spiritual nourishment that they would need to be able to recognize Christ, acknowledge Christ, and believe in Christ when the time came, and to grasp the gospel when the time came. And what he's complaining about is not only can you not grasp the solid food, you can't handle the solid food right now, you guys can't even handle the milk. You need someone to reintroduce milk into your diet because you can't even handle that right now. Okay, what, for our purposes, what's crucial here is this concept of the stoicheia from the beginning of the revelations of God, these elementary concepts that God introduced to Israel in the earliest parts of his dealings with them as he came and revealed his truth to them. There are certain elemental truths, foundational truths that he was introducing to them. Okay. Let's look at Galatians, where the same idea comes up. In Galatians, I'll be looking at 3:29, and we'll go into chapter 4. Now, if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's descendants, heirs according to promise. Now, I say, as long as the heir is a child, he does not differ at all from a servant, although he is owner of everything. My New American Standard translates that slave, as you know, the same word for slave and servant. The same word could mean either in Greek. And it really basically, the reason I go with servant is because I don't think the connotation of slave in our thinking is not what he has in mind here. What he has in mind is the lower social status of the child. At the level of social status, a child might as well just be a servant in terms of his privileges, his prerogatives, his freedom, and so on. He's just like any other servant. Notice that the imagery here, once again, identifies, as we go through this passage, he's going to identify the Jews under the covenant as children as compared to their adulthood. It's exactly the same kind of imagery that's implicit in Hebrews. They were drinking milk, and they didn't yet have solid food. But when Christ came, when the gospel is proclaimed, now we're being confronted with solid food. There's a very similar kind of imagery going on here. Now, I say, as long as the heir is a child, he does not differ at all from a servant, although he is owner of everything. But he is subject or subservient to guardians and managers until the date set by the father. So also we, and he's talking about himself as a Jew at this point, so also we, while we were children, were made subject or subservient to the fundamental requirements, the stoicheia, of the covenantal order, the cosmos. Okay, now, this will be controversial. It'll especially be controversial when we look at the same passage in Colossians. But he has this phrase here, the stoicheia tou kosmou. The stoicheia, the same word that we encountered in Hebrews, and then of the cosmos. And I don't know any English translation that doesn't translate cosmos world. I have never seen any commentary that, of course, that's not saying anything. I've never seen any commentary, so. I'm not aware of anyone who takes that in any other way than the world, but it makes absolutely no sense, neither here nor in Colossians. So I'm going to propose that what he means by the stoicheia of the cosmos is we have to stop and consider what cosmos means. Cosmos doesn't mean the universe. Cosmos doesn't mean all of reality and everything is in it. Cosmos is the opposite of chaos. There's chaos, disorder, and then there's cosmos, order. And cosmos can be used in any way in which it's appropriate to talk about an order as opposed to a chaos. Now, the most typical way that the word is used is to describe the order of all of cosmic reality. And so that's a very, very common use of the word cosmos. The stars, the planets, and all that's out there. That's the extent of my astronomy. That ordered system is the cosmos. But there are other ordered systems, and in fact in the New Testament, cosmos is used to talk about the ordered system of a woman's face. That's where we get the word cosmetics. Ordering one's face. And it's used that way, I think, by Peter at one point. Well, I'm proposing that the cosmos he has in mind here is not the cosmos of all of reality. He's not talking about the elements of the world. What he's talking about are the elements of that ordered system that was the Mosaic covenant. And I don't, you know, just this ordered system that set out all the requirements, all that is required of you if you are going to live in a covenantal relationship with God. You'll do this, you'll do this, you'll do this, you'll do this this way, you'll do this other thing this other way. If you don't do this, this is going to be the result, this is going to be the consequences. That is a cosmos, an ordered way of living that has been ordered by God himself. And my contention is that that's what Paul's talking about. And then we have the stoicheia of the cosmos. What are the elementary requirements, regulations, rules, concepts in terms of which that cosmos has been given to us? What are the stoicheia of that cosmos? Well, notice I think it'll make sense that that's what he's saying as the passage goes on. So also, while we were children, we were made subject or subservient to the fundamental requirements, the stoicheia, of the covenantal order, the cosmos. But when the fullness of time came, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, so that he might redeem those who are under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. We might enter into adulthood and no longer be children. Because you are sons, God has sent forth the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. Therefore, you are no longer a servant, but a son, back to the original point he made. As long as you were still a child, even though by rights and inheritance you owned everything, yet you were no better than a servant in the household in terms of your experience. Therefore, you are no longer a servant, but a son, and if a son, then an heir through God. However, at that time, when you did not know God, you were made subservient, or you were living in subjection, to those which by nature are no gods. But now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how is it that you turn back again to the weak and worthless stoicheia, to the weak and worthless fundamental requirements to which you desire to be made subservient all over again? Okay, now, lest we have any confusion about what he's talking about, he goes on. You observe days and months and seasons and years. I fear for you that perhaps I have labored over you in vain. So what are the stoicheia? Well, he gives us some examples of them. It's the observance of days, Sabbath keeping, of months, of seasons, of years. That God had built festivals and jubilee and Sabbath keeping and all kinds of things regulated by the calendar into the cosmos of the life of people living under the covenant that God made with Israel. Those were the stoicheia of some of the stoicheia of that cosmos. And his whole concern here is, why are you returning to that? Those were the guardians and managers that were tutoring you to lead you to Christ as long as you were a child. But you are no longer a child. You have been brought into the full adulthood of complete understanding of what God intends to bless you with. You are a full-grown son now. You're no longer under managers and stewards who manage your affairs and who regulate your life as when you were a child. You now know the truth. Why are you going back to become subservient to, what's a subservient? A Bulgarian, I guess. You become subservient to those rules and regulations that only had a temporary and provisional value in God's scheme of things, and you're not simply participating in and enjoying the full enlightened understanding of God, of the freedom that you have in Jesus. Now, there's a lot more to say about that. For my purposes, what's important about this is to recognize, once again, he seems to be dealing with this concept that what you have in the Mosaic Covenant is not a version of how God wants to deal with mankind, but merely a shadow of what God wants to deal with mankind that disappears in the full light of the sun. That's the concept here. And in that Mosaic Covenant were certain stoicheia that we have to understand in order to even understand who Jesus is and what he's doing. But once we've understood who Jesus is and what he's doing, we no longer are subject to the order, the cosmos, in which those stoicheia were revealed to us. Okay, one more passage. Colossians chapter 2, starting with verse 8. See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the stoicheia to kosmou, according to the fundamental requirements of the covenantal order, the cosmos, rather than according to Christ. For in him all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form, and in him you have been made complete, and he is the head over all rule and authority. And in him you were also circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, in the removal of the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ, having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised up with him through faith in the working of God, who raised him from the dead. When you were dead in your transgressions and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he made you alive together with him, having forgiven us all our transgressions, having canceled out the certificate of debt consisting of decrees against us, which was hostile to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. When he had disarmed the rulers and authorities, he made a public display of them, having triumphed over them through him. Therefore, and let me just comment on that last one. You know, for years, I think it's because early information that people had given me about Colossians, kind of orienting me to what was going on in Colossians, had made me think that Colossians was all about some kind of weird Greek philosophical cult that was beginning to influence the Christians, and they had all kinds of, and they had the worship of angels and all kinds of beliefs and elemental spirits that were stacked several stories high in the universe, and there was just one really, really bizarre picture. So when you get to 15, when he had disarmed the rulers and authorities, you're prepped to think that those rulers and authorities are some kind of demonic powers that are ruling the universe. I would contend that that's not what's going on. Notice he says in verse 2:12, having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised up with him through faith in the working of God who raised him from the dead. The disarming of the rulers and authorities was not his crucifixion. The disarming of the rulers and authorities was his resurrection. And the rulers and authorities were the Jewish rulers and authorities and the Roman rulers and authorities. The Jewish and the Roman rulers and authorities deigned to have the authority to dictate whether the Son of God would live or die. And the resurrection was this incredible triumph over them. And I think that's what Jesus is talking about. When he had disarmed the rulers and authorities by raising from the dead, he made a public display of disgrace. He had put them in disgrace, having triumphed over them through him, that is, in Jesus being raised from the dead. So I think that's what we're talking about here. So we have died and been raised again with Christ, Paul is arguing in Colossians. And therefore, 16, therefore, let no one act as your judge in regard to food or drink or in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day, things which are a mere shadow of what is to come. But the substance belongs to Christ. Let no one keep defrauding you of your prize by delighting in self-abasement and the worship of, most translations have angels, I don't think it's angels, delighting in self-abasement and the worship of divinely revealed instructions. In other words, it's what he's getting at is the worship of the text of the scripture itself, as in contrast to the worship of God. Let no one keep defrauding you of your prize by delighting in self-abasement and the worship of divinely revealed instructions, taking his stand on what he thinks he has seen there, inflated without cause by his fleshly mind, and not holding fast to the head from whom the entire body, being supplied and held together by the joints and ligaments, grows with a great growth which is from God. Then 20. If you have died with Christ to the stoicheia tou kosmou, to the fundamental requirements of the covenantal order, why, as if you were living in that cosmos, not in the world, not why as if you were living in the world, which is what most translations have, and, well, why wouldn't I live as if I were in the world? That's where I am. Why, as if you were living in the cosmos, the very cosmos he's been talking about in the stoicheia tou kosmou, why, as if you were living within that covenantal order, do you submit yourself to decrees such as do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, which all refer to things destined to perish with use in accordance with the commandments and teaching of men? These are matters which have, to be sure, the appearance of wisdom in self-made religion and self-abasement and severe treatment of the body, but are of no value against fleshly indulgence. Okay, again, we have the stoicheia tou kosmou coming up, and he's saying that we have died to that in Christ. And I think what he's getting at is when you come to confront the reality of what Jesus taught and what happened when Jesus died on the cross and what he taught about the significance of him dying on the cross, when you come to that point, you're acknowledging the death of Jesus. That's what he means by dying with him, I think. You're acknowledging and identifying with the death of Jesus makes you no, renders the Mosaic covenant no longer really relevant to you in the same way. It's just not where you're going to live your life now. Why would you live your life there? He says those were shadows of that which was about to come, but the substance belongs to Christ, he says. So if you now understand and have and are in possession of the real thing, why would you obsess with the shadows of that thing? That's his argument. Well, what are the stoicheia tou kosmou here? Well, he tells us. Observing festivals, new moons, Sabbath days, dietary restrictions, food and drink. And earlier he talked about, in the first time we come across this, he said, don't be captive to philosophy and empty deception, according to the stoicheia tou kosmou, rather than according to Christ. And according to the traditions of men, he adds. So it's the traditions of men which are the various interpretations of how you live under the Mosaic covenant. He's saying, don't be captive to those things. Be captive to Christ instead. Okay, so what's the bottom line here? Look at all the things that we have included when you put those passages together. You have all the new moons, festivals, Sabbaths, the being ruled by the calendar in the way the covenant said you should. You have the sacrificial system alluded to in Hebrews, the washings, the placing on of hands. And so I think everything that is entailed in the sacrificial system of offerings and so on and so forth. There's basically, by the time we're done, nothing left out. Every element of the Mosaic covenant is seen by the apostles as the cosmos, the ordered system through which God intended to reveal those foundational elemental concepts that we need to understand and grasp if we are to understand Christ and who he is. And God revealed those things to the Jews through his working with the Jews, through the covenant that he made with the Jews. And every one of these authors are in agreement. When you get to the point where you understand where they were to lead, what was to be the outcome of those things, in Jesus, one of a kind, unique event on the cross, once you grasp that and understand what that's all about, all that stuff becomes irrelevant to you and passes away, just as the shadows are no longer what you want to be looking at in order to understand the truth when you're staring the truth straight in the face. Why look to the shadows when you can look at the real deal? Okay, well, when it comes then to our topic about the sacrificial system, that's how I started. That's what I was suggesting, is that the perspective of the apostles is each and every one of these rituals, the scapegoat, the Day of Atonement, all the various offerings that are prescribed in Leviticus, the Passover, the Passover event, the various other kinds of redemption that are built into the covenant, all of those things are just bits and pieces providing concepts, categories, ideas, notions that are going to be built on in order to understand what Jesus is doing when he dies on the cross. And I think it's an unusual way for us Christians to think about that relationship, because I think the idea that I got growing up was, in the Old Testament, there's just a law. There's a law of the universe. God just needs blood. And if he can't have the blood of Jesus, then he's going to have the blood of an animal. So the reason there was a sacrificial system that required the blood of the animal is because God needs his blood. And then we get to Jesus, and finally he's got some blood that really is so satisfying that he's not going to need blood again. I mean, that's pretty crass, but something not too different from that was the underlying logic of how I understood this to be happening. So that it wasn't that God was in the old covenant anticipating the truth that was the only truth and the truth that had always been the truth before all time. It wasn't that. It was that God had put in place a temporary fix on human sin until he could actually repair it once and for all. So that the old covenant was dealing with the problem, but it was dealing with the problem in a provisional, temporary sort of way. But when you get to Jesus, now he deals with it once and for all permanently. What I'm suggesting is that this whole business of stoicheia tu kosmou and shadows of things to come and so on is a different way of looking at it. Those never dealt with the problem. They were only shadows of the solution to the problem. Let's see. Let me read this quickly, more about shadows, just to let you see how they're thinking about that, if I can find it. Okay, Hebrews 8. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, talking about, is it Melchizedek there? Okay. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things, just as Moses was warned by God when he was about to erect the tabernacle. For see, he says, that you make all things according to the pattern which was shown you on the mountain. So now he's talking about the temple worship itself and the offerings and the ritual of all the sacrifices. And he says with respect to the rituals and the sacrifices that the priests who are performing those rituals and sacrifices are serving a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. And then later in Hebrews in chapter 10, for the law, since it has a shadow of the good things to come and not the very form of things, can never, by the same sacrifices which they offer continually year by year, to bring those who approach God in worship to that consciousness and awareness of divine mercy that God intends for them. That is, They can never bring those who approach God in worship to that consciousness and awareness of divine mercy that God intends for them. The translation, most English translations have, can never make perfect those who draw near, but that make perfect is a very, very misleading translation, I would argue. God's intention was to use the sacrificial system as a shadow and Jesus' death as the reality that would bring us to an awareness of the incredible mercy of God such that we can become conscious and aware that God intends to deal with me in mercy and not in judgment. That is a perfected consciousness. That is being made perfect. That is having had God's revelation of his truth brought to its intended goal, its intended result, where I now completely understand what's going on here. God is not going to give me what I deserve. God is not going to destroy me like he ought to. He's going to instead, out of a profound mercy, grant me the blessing of Abraham instead, even though I don't deserve it. It's only when we really finally grasp that that we have reached that level that Hebrews likes to use the word teleosis, and we translate it very misleadingly, perfection. But it's not perfection. It's a perfect understanding, perhaps, or not even perfect, but a complete and full understanding. But until I fully and completely understand the mercy of God as that is represented and embodied in the event of Jesus dying on the cross, until I understand that, I don't understand. I have not been brought to the full understanding of who God is and what he's doing. Well, what brings us to that understanding? What he's arguing in Hebrews 10 is not the shadows, not the mirror, because the covenant contains only shadows of that. But it can't really bring me to a full and complete and adequate grasp of the mercy of God and its implications. Only by looking at Jesus' death on the cross do I finally fully understand the extent and the nature of God's mercy. So Jesus accomplished what the law never could accomplish. But what's being accomplished is not some objective cleansing of moral guilt out there in the cosmos. He's not thinking of this objectively. He's thinking of this subjectively. It's my conscience that's cleansed, not the universe. And that's, as we will proceed, you'll see that that's one of the important differences between my view of the atonement and the more traditional view of the atonement. The more traditional view of the atonement sees that there's some kind of imbalance in the universe due to human sin that needs to be put back in balance, needs to be put aright, or God is all out of sorts. And in order for God not to be all out of sorts, that needs to be brought back into balance. And what I'm going to argue is that doesn't speak much for mercy. If God can't tolerate imbalance, then he's not merciful. He just needs justice, and justice needs to be done. And perhaps he mercifully found a way to get justice done. I think that's the traditional view. So it's not devoid of mercy. But you don't have a God who simply is looking at the imbalance of my life and the brokenness of my life and the destructive reality of my life and just saying, okay, I'll absorb it. I'll accept it. I won't give you what justice demands. I'm simply going to bless you instead. And in my view of the atonement, that's where I'm going to end up. But that's what God is doing, is he's simply letting go, forgiving, overlooking, taking my sins and making them as irrelevant to me as if they existed on the other side of the universe. They don't attach to me any longer, as far as God is concerned, in terms of how he's going to deal with me and treat me. Okay. So going back then, just reviewing briefly what we looked at last week, so what were those elements that the covenant had that we need to understand Jesus? Well, with the offerings and the sacrifices, I would argue that those offerings and sacrifices were ways in which the worshiper was constantly appealing to God for mercy. And he was appealing to God for mercy by giving him a gift, by offering him a gift. Now, that gift was a token. It didn't pay for anything. It didn't purchase anything. It wasn't valuable enough to God to be worth much to him. I mean, as God says in one of the passages we looked at last week, if I really wanted to eat, aren't there thousands of cattle out there on the hills that I just eat them? I mean, if that's really what I wanted, I have it available. I don't need any more meat from you in order to eat. So what's significant about the gift being offered is not its value to God. What's significant about the gift being offered is that it means something, manifests something about the subjective condition of the worshiper. Let me give you this token. It may not be valuable to you, God, but it is costing me. So let me give you this costly thing and ask you that you not give me what I deserve, but you be merciful to me instead. Well, that's exactly one way of understanding, one way, one element, one part of what's happening on the cross. Jesus is a gift that he himself is offering up. We aren't. God or Jesus himself is offering it up in our behalf. It is costing him a great deal. It's costing him his very life, just as the token that the worshiper offered in the Old Testament cost the animal its life. It's costing Jesus something, and the cost then becomes the token of sincerity in appealing to God for mercy. The other thing you see in the offerings and the sacrifices is God required that the offering be unblemished, that there be a purity about the animal that was being offered up. And I think that was intended to anticipate what characterizes the nature of Jesus' offering. It was important that Jesus be blemish-free morally. Jesus was a sinless individual offering himself up for us. On the other hand, you have the scapegoat. Entirely different ritual, entirely different thing, where the high priest simply puts both hands on the goat, and it's prays over it, confesses the sins of Israel over it, and it's as if the sins are going on to the goat, and then the goat is being sent out into the wilderness. What's the significance of that? In terms of how God is going to treat me, does he see my sins on me? Or are my sins so far removed from me in his vision of me that they're irrelevant to how he's going to treat me and how he's going to deal with me? That's the metaphor, the picture of the scapegoat. They've been taken so far away that they don't even count any longer with respect to how God's going to deal with me. In both the scapegoat and the offering, you have the element of the laying on of hands where there's an identification of me, the worshiper, with the offering, that's probably more relevant to the offering, an identification with the offering. The Day of Atonement combines all the elements of the scapegoat and the sacrifice, it seems to me. The redemption, which happens in a number of different ways in the Mosaic Covenant, it has to do with the cost. If I want some freedom, it's going to cost. You don't just get given freedom without a cost, and that's one of the stoicheion, one of the elemental principles here. What's the freedom that we find in Jesus? Freedom, I think, from the destiny of condemnation. That all of us live our lives under the doom, the impending doom of coming to the end of my life and being judged by God and being condemned by God. That's what all of us deserve. And so we live under the doom of that. But Jesus paid a costly price in order that you and I can be free from that doom, that condemnation. That's the redemption that's in Jesus, I think. The Passover event was pretty significant because in the Passover event, we have it emphasized that the threat that rests over us is death. But simply by this lamb that was slain and the blood over the doorposts, God did not give the people in that house what he had threatened. Instead of giving them what he had threatened, they escape that destiny of death. And so obviously that becomes a very, very important picture of Jesus. Everybody lives under the threat of death, the death angel. Not, I don't mean physical death, but I mean the death of eternal destruction in the age to come. Everyone lives under that threat of that death. But because of the blood of the Passover lamb, Jesus, some of us are not going to get what's threatened to all mankind. So what I'm arguing is that Jesus' death was unique and unprecedented. You don't have any sacrifice that exactly matches it. You don't have any ritual that exactly matches it. What God was accomplishing in Jesus was completely unprecedented and completely unique. But the elements of what happened in Jesus and the elements, the stoicheia, that we need to put together in order to understand the meaning of Jesus' death were scattered throughout the Mosaic covenant and what it was trying to say and what it was trying to reveal and the various pieces it was trying to give us in order that we might understand it. But there are two significant differences, there may be more, but at least two most significant differences between Jesus' death and anything that's happening in the Mosaic covenant. One is that Jesus' death was not carried out as a ritual. I mean, it just wasn't. It was capital punishment by the Romans is what it was. It was a political act is what it was. It was not carried out in the form of a ritual. The Mosaic covenant was prescribing rituals. Jesus did not perform a ritual on the cross. And then secondly, and this was new to me, this was interesting, Jesus' death is clearly and unmistakably, I think, punitive. He is being punished by God for your and my sins, I will argue. So he's receiving the punishment that we deserve. So what happens to him is punitive. But notice that that's, if it's there at all, it's only very, very faint in any of the Old Testament sacrifices and rituals. The scapegoat isn't punished. He's just taken out in the wilderness. The animals are not punished. They just need their blood. And they're giving up their life in order that you can have their blood. There's no real significant hint that this animal is going to stand in my place and we're going to allow God in the form of the priest or something to punish the animal to get the punishment that we deserve. It just isn't there. At least I don't see it. So that part of what is happening in Jesus is somewhat unanticipated. And we perhaps wouldn't even know that if that weren't the piece that Jesus was most explicit about teaching us before he went to the cross, because he told us why he was going to the cross. I'm going to the cross for your sins. And then as Paul fleshes that out, it's the wrath of God is being poured out against him. I better stop there. Questions and comments?
Thanks, Jack. That was your treatment of Galatians and Colossians was just so clarifying. And the stoicheia, what is it?
Tou kosmou.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if your treatment of that is correct, which it seems very logical, it just makes those passages so straightforward instead of like bouncing from Jewish stuff to worldly spirits and stuff like you talked about. Your understanding was that, you know, the funky stuff that was going on in Colossae or whatever. I just wanted to, we talked at the end of last week about a passage that you cleared up for me about the cosmos. thing, and I thought maybe it would be good to connect what you talked about today for everybody to that, because of that misunderstanding that I had of that passage.
Yeah, remind me.
Where were we last week? It was right toward the end.
See, was I here? talk a little bit about it, and that'll jog my...
Well, it was the same issue. It had to do with the cosmos, and I got confused because I thought that it was talking about...
Oh, yes. Hebrews, yeah. Hebrews chapter 10. Ten 5. It was the passage where he's quoting Psalm 40.
Right. Correct.
For it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. For therefore, here's the New American Standard translation. Therefore, when he comes into the world, he says, "Sacrifice and offering you have not desired, but a body you prepared for me. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you have taken no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me to do your will, O God." After saying above, "Sacrifices and offerings and whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you have not desired, nor have you taken pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law," then he said, "Behold, I have come to do your will." He takes away the first in order to establish the second. By this will we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Now, what confused Trevor is there are many people who would translate this passage, and you can kind of see why you get led in that direction by verse 5. When it says, "Therefore, when he comes into the world," well, who must the he be except Jesus?
Right.
I mean, who else is coming into the world, right? So, "Therefore, when he comes into the world," he says, but my contention would be that's a mistranslation. The he is David, who's writing the psalm, and it shouldn't be translated "when he comes into the world," but rather something like "when he comes to address the matter of the cosmos." What cosmos? The cosmos that I've just been talking about today, the regulations of the covenantal order that was put in place by God. When he's dealing with that subject and giving us his evaluation of that, what does he say? And then he quotes Psalm 40, is, "I guess you don't want these offerings, do you? What you want is my will. You want my inwardness. You want my subjective response to you to be one of gratefully wanting to know you and serve you. That's what you want from me." And that's the whole point of the psalm, is you really don't care about all this smoke and incense and stuff. God, you don't care about that. If you did, I'd give it to you. But what you want is me. And so the psalm is not a messianic psalm. Particularly, I mean, it has messianic overtones of sorts, but it's not really a messianic psalm. That's not Jesus who's speaking when he says, "Then I said, behold, I have come to do your will." That's David speaking. So it's David saying, "When I came to the realization that you don't want my offerings, what you want is me, then I offered myself to you. I've come to do your will, O God."
Great, thanks. Yeah, and I had one other thing, a question about, you said earlier when we don't know the truth because we're unwilling to know it, we can't see it, we're slow because we're unwilling to see it. And I was just thinking that, isn't that true of kind of any system that we're trying to grasp? I mean, if I was trying to understand radical Islam, from where I sit right now, I don't want to know that because I don't believe it's true, I don't have any inclination, but if so, I don't know, say I was persuadable and I met some, you know, radical Muslim who got me thinking that this could be true, and so I started to investigate it and I opened my mind to the possibility of it being true. Well, I could go down that road and be persuaded that that was true. How is, and come to fully embrace it because I was willing to believe that that was true. How is what the phenomenon that you're describing, I mean, I'm hoping that it has to be somehow different when it comes to knowing the true truth, not a pseudo-truth.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's two different phenomena that happen. One of them is only right and good and proper and rational, and the other is evil. The one that's right and true and proper and rational is that all of us approach life and reality through a set of lenses, if you will, the paradigm, our worldview, our pre-understanding, whatever you want to call it. No matter what new comes along, I'm going to understand it in terms of what I already believe is true. I mean, notice that none of us have a perspective that we believe is false. You know, I hold this perspective and I believe it's eminently false. You know, it's just, we just don't do that. We all think that we believe what we believe because we believe it's in touch with reality. And that becomes our paradigm, our worldview, our pre-understanding. It's the set of lenses through which we look at, perceive, understand, and evaluate everything else that comes our way. Well, because we think it's true, if something comes along that we don't, you know, really quite know what to do with, our natural tendency is to just say, well, I don't know. I don't know how that fits. Mm-hmm. It's a rare person that is going to react to that by going, well, probably everything I have ever believed is wrong. I need to start over. Right. I mean, look what chaos that would throw our lives in if we did that, if we proceeded that way. So the rational thing to do, the intelligent thing to do, the commonsensical thing to do, the thing that I think we're hardwired to do, is to be conservative. Assume that we're right until it doesn't work any longer, until I just have to reconsider and reevaluate because I just can't make, there's just too many things I can't make work. I must be wrong. I must have a bad view of reality. So there is that conservative nature of human knowledge that acts like, I mean, you could describe it as, I don't want to go there, but the not wanting to go there is not a moral and spiritual resistance to it. I already know what's true, and that's inconsistent with it, so why would I spend my time on that? And I think that's a very rational response. I was down in Southern Oregon earlier this weekend, and there's a man who is really shaken by the discovery of the ossuary with supposedly Jesus' bones and his wife Mary Magdalene and their baby's bones and, you know, stuff like that. And I... you know, my perspective, I mean, he's very troubled by it because he's willing to grant real weight to that as evidence. And he's absolutely right. If that's true, then everything I believe is wrong. If Jesus' bones really are in there, then that calls into question everything about my worldview. Well, his perspective was, it's intellectual dishonesty for me to not take a look at it. From my perspective, I'm tired. I mean, I don't have time to look into every challenge that comes along, every claim that gets made, every assertion that gets made that if it were true, would completely and totally destroy my worldview. And I don't think I'm being intellectually dishonest by being unwilling to go there. I'm just being commonsensical. I am convinced this belief that I have, I think, is true. I think Jesus really was raised from the dead. And because I really think that's true, it's a simple matter of logic that his bones are not in some ossuary. So, or his bones are in the ossuary and he's raised from the dead. I don't know, but I haven't figured that one out yet. But I'm not going to accept that as a direct and immediate threat to my faith until I have some other reasons to think that my belief is maybe false. Then all of a sudden, I would be willing to come back and look at the kind of thing he's looking at and add more urgency to my need to check it out. But why do I not feel the urgency to check it out? Because I have no reason to think that Jesus wasn't raised from the dead for all kinds of other reasons. So that, I think, is not a matter of unwillingness. I believe I can sincerely say that if Jesus didn't raise from the dead, then I am willing to not be a believer. I don't think I'm morally and spiritually resistant to the idea of not being a believer. And in fact, what Jesus teaches me would be that would be morally and spiritually irresponsible of me to not be willing to be an unbeliever were it not true. I mean, I think I would be remiss to not have that willingness. There's a different level at which that unwillingness operates, and that is at a deeper inward level where our rebellion against God resides. And at that level, I think you see that operating in people all around you, where the smartest people in the world, you know, many, many times more intelligent than I am, who demonstrate their intelligence over and over and over again in various areas of knowledge and so on. Take someone like Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell had a brilliant mind. There's just no question about that. But he wrote the stupidest book that the world has ever seen, Why I Am Not a Christian, by Bertrand Russell. There's this brilliant mind producing a really incredibly stupid book. Why? I think because deep down at the core of his being, he was really so invested in Christianity not being true that he's willing to promote even really lousy arguments in order to think in his own mind, tell himself in his own mind that he has a reason not believing, that he's actually noble for not believing.
Unlike C.S. Lewis, who tried to do the same thing but became convinced.
Right, yeah. Right. And what makes the difference, whether at that deep-seated level of inwardness we're willing or not, that's a gift. I mean, all of us would be there if God had not miraculously invaded our lives and touched us and made us willing to bow the knee to God and truth. All of us would be resisting it if God hadn't changed us.
Thank you. Okay. For years now, I've been troubled by what the New Testament says about who Jesus is. When John says, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." But he never explains which lamb that he is. You know, the once a year lamb, the monthly lamb, the Passover lamb. Yeah, you know, just there you go. And then he's referred to as the Passover, and then he's referred to sort of as a ransom. And then another time he's referred to as the propitiation. So it seems that you touched on that early about all of these metaphors that the New Testament uses and says Jesus is this. All those metaphors seem to me that they'd be comfortable sitting at the same table, but they would never come into complete agreement about what they're saying. In that a propitiatory offering has got nothing to do with the Passover lamb. Nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like they would look at each other and go, "Well, I'm not even in your sphere of explanation." So is that part of where you're going here? Is it to understand these metaphors in context of what the author's saying at that moment?
Right.
And that doesn't mean he's not the Passover. It just means maybe the Passover isn't everything you thought it was. And it's not that he's not the propitiation, but maybe that propitiation isn't everything you thought it was. Maybe ransom is, you see what I'm saying?
I'm not sure what you mean by everything you thought it was. I would put it differently. It's not that he's not the Passover. It's that that's not all he is. It's not that he's not a propitiatory offering, but that's not all he is. That he incorporates the truth, the elemental truth, the stoicheion. He incorporates that stoicheion in who he is, but there are other stoicheia that he incorporates in who he is as well. Other concepts, ideas, pictures, metaphors that are needed to really adequately understand what's going on the cross.
And so when Jesus is there in the garden, and he's saying, "Gee, I don't want to do this. Is there any other way?" And it seems to be the answer he gets is, "No, there's not any other way." Which, I mean, that's the traditional interpretation. There is no other way. The universe, this reality is built so this has got to happen. And I think that leads to a lot of,
right,
you know, adamantine arguments.
And that's the question I'm slowly moving toward, and my answer is going to be, yes, there's a sense in which it had to be. But that sense in which it had to be is probably not the sense in which most of us would like to think.
And my question is, are you going to address, if I had stood there and said, wait a minute, Jesus, got to interrupt here. What is the this that you don't want to do? What is it the what is this thing you think you're being asked to do? Is he responding to crucifixion, or is he responding to propitiation? I hope you address that, because if I could have just, excuse me, hate to interrupt, but I just need, you know, I need to know what you're talking about here. It's like no one's ever really, they just jump on their favorite answer and run with it.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Well, I'm not prepared to do that, but yeah, by the time we're done, I'll answer that, I think.
Well, yeah, that what I was thinking about has kind of been touched on. I really appreciate everything you said, and it gives me a lot more to chew on, especially about the Old Covenant and how, and especially how these, you know, Galatians and Colossians and Hebrews can be talking about that and not jumping back and forth, as was already said. I don't know if I can figure a question yet, but it has to do with, okay, so this really, what Paul and others talked about, really related to the Old Covenant and to people who had been given, told the gospel message. So whether they had been Jewish or not, they were relating to what, or at least they were meant to relate from there to what Christ did, and then, and not to go back when someone came and said, you know, well, you need to be doing all these rituals and things, then they're supposed to be, you know, seeing that they don't, that this was this brand new thing, and just like you were saying. So for someone now today reading the New Testament, especially, but not, even if they've read the Old Testament, not having this background of the Old Covenant, and then hearing Paul say things like he says in Galatians, you know, he says a lot of things about, you know, I'm not to rebuild what was torn down. I'm not to go back to the way the law was. I've thought a lot about how in our lives, just whether, you know, we're not Jewish, but we try to do these things to be worthy of God. Does that relate? Can we relate to what Paul's saying when we've had our, you know, our Christian culture system and not the Old Covenant to look at? Does that make sense?
Yes, I think so. By the, I think the logic of Galatians is pretty subtle, but I think if we finally grasp what his argument is there, and we'll be getting into that in a few weeks, not in this series, but after that, when you finally get to the root or to the bottom of what he's doing in something like the book of Galatians, you can then apply the same kind of argument to things that are not Judaism, not the Mosaic Covenant, but any sort of religious system where analogous kind of claims are being made about that religious system that are being made about the law of Moses. But that's a longer story. I mean, I'll have to, hopefully in a few weeks, I'll spell that out. But yes, I think the same argument could be made against every and any form of legalism and creedalism, that they're both of them. Every form of legalism, every form of creedalism is a false gospel, as far as Paul's concerned, I would argue. So.
Thanks. This is kind of, it goes along with what Deanna was asking, but I'm thinking about people who have no Jewish, I mean, we have no Jewish background, and comment on how we can understand what Christ did without, I mean, or can we fully understand what his sacrifice was, what he did, without understanding those basic principles? I mean, when Paul was writing, he was saying, you should have understood all these things, and then the reality of what Jesus did would have made really good sense to you. But here we're in a culture and a time where just about none of us understand that, and yet we have Jesus' death here. I mean, comment on that.
Yeah, I don't think we could. I don't think we could translate it into other language. We could. We don't have to use the biblical language or the language of the Mosaic Covenant, but the concepts would have to be there. And if people don't have those concepts, we'd have to introduce them to those concepts. I mean, you basically would have to educate them in thousands of years of history to bring them up to speed in order to set the framework for understanding who Jesus is. I think that's true. I need to stop here. Thank you.